Empire Podcast this week. We're talking Tolkien with Tolkien star Nicholas Holt.
I did not know how to pronounce his name.
Yeah.
It's pronounced Tolkien.
Tolkien. We've all been doing it wrong.
Judi Dench
years.
Helped because she did the voiceover for a documentary that I watched.
Okay.
Judi Dench is never wrong.
Plus, the usual news and nonsense on the movie podcast that just spent an inordinate amount of time looking at Avengers dildos. How's your weekend planning going?
If only that were a joke.
Well, we should explain that, shouldn't we? Hello, Father. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to the Empire Podcast. This week, I am joined by two colleagues of such lethal cunning. And we are joined, as you've already heard, by James Dyer, who, I mean, is here, and that is inarguable.
That's
Thanks.
True. Yeah.
It is
Welcome,
true.
James.
Should we discuss? Do you want to introduce Helen before we discuss the dildos? Not that those two things are connected, but just, you know.
What? Jeez. No, they are not.
Hey,
no.
You brought them up on
yeah.
your laptop.
No. Well,
in fact,
at your
yes.
request.
And that URL came up surprisingly quickly, Helen.
Almost like it was cached.
It was not. Oh, my God. This is slander and libel,
I mean,
just for the record.
You say that.
Please welcome our geek queen.
Thank you.
Helen O'Hara. Helen, why were you telling us about Avengers dildos?
You were telling... Somebody else... Right. I am being completely reasonable and getting a large, extremely geeky necklace made by a lovely lady from Greenwich Market. They go by Richardson and Richardson. Go check them out. They're lovely.
Yep.
Anyway, in the course of discussing this kind of geeky tie-in
product...
What were
you asking her to build?
Yeah.
You guys...
What sort of necklace was this?
No, it's just a necklace. I'm not okay. going to spoil the surprise, you know.
Okay.
Hashtag, yeah, it's for the live
don't
show.
Spoil the endgame, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
But in the course of discussing geeky tie-in products, you brought up Avengers dildos.
Helen, you shouldn't feel embarrassed. We're very sex positive here. We're fine.
I mean,
it's all good.
I'm not,
it's all good.
Not sex positive. I'm just maligned.
For our listeners, we should probably say that if you do Google Avengers dildos, which of course you now all will,
yes.
there's an astonishing
and
collection
terrifying
available.
Yes.
Some of which, the Holt one in particular, will do you a mischief. What I liked about it is that there's variety to it. So the Captain America one is a butt plug, America's butt plug, which is nice. The Black Widow fleshlight is a bit ew.
They're all ew yeah. to various degrees. But
the
you know
Thanos
what?
One is particularly upsetting.
The yeah, Thanos one is very upsetting.
What is the Thanos one a gauntlet?
It's a gauntlet.
Yeah,
it's a giant fist with infinity gems on it.
All right.
I can't recommend them. Although we will be giving
listeners.
Them out at the live podcast on Saturday.
And hey, we're in the bell end game now.
Oh,
so.
God.
Come on.
No.
That's fine.
Was it?
That's totally fine. We may have to put the explicit warning on this week's podcast.
Do you think?
Right from the off. But that's what happens when you bring up dildos.
It's true.
Anyway, welcome. And what should we do? Should we have a question?
Yes.
Let's have a question. And it comes from Twitter. And it's from @IAmGalIncognito.
Good to know.
And they say, after enduring Nutty by Nature 2 with my son, he's recovering from surgery, so I couldn't argue.
I'm
Our
so
best
sorry.
Wishes to your son. Starring Will Arnett, Peter Stormare, Bobby Cannavale, Maya Rudolph, and Jackie Chan, I wonder, what animated film cast would you prefer to see together in a live-action movie? Good question.
Ooh.
Mm.
This is a good question.
I have an answer.
Okay.
And that answer is Shark Tale.
Uh-huh.
So we're going back now to the real heyday of the sort of celebrity voice cast in a DreamWorks animated film.
Okay.
And yet they used it on Shark Tale. I mean, you've got Will Smith, you've got Robert De Niro, you've got Martin freaking Scorsese, you've got Renee Zellweger, you've got Angelina Jolie. That would be a fun cast for a film.
It's a fun cast.
Yeah.
But is it a better cast than Ants?
Well, the thing is, you know, Woody Allen these days, problematic, isn't it? I was going to say Ants otherwise, and then I thought, you know what? No, I'm not getting into it.
Oh, yeah, but it's got, okay. It's got Woody Allen.
Yeah.
It's got Sly Stallone.
Uh-huh.
It's got Sharon Stone.
Yeah.
And other people. Chris Walken's in it, right?
Uh-huh.
That's four. That's four good people at the time.
I love Ants, so.
I love Ants!
Yeah.
This is great. See, the problem is, most Disney animated movies, they go for no marks, like the one and only wickedly talented Adele Dazeem. Like, no one's ever heard of her.
She'll never make an impact on stage or on screen. Come
or
on.
Jonathan Groff. What's he ever done?
I mean,
like, nothing. So, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
That's a fair point.
We can't even joke about
and
that.
And Mindhunter. Okay, that's another fair point.
Yeah.
Okay, that's fine. But they're not really starry casts.
No, they're not.
And even Pixar in the beginning wasn't all about the stars.
And even when they go for stars, they'll mix it up. You know, they're not going for, you know, sort of Tom Hanks level every time. It's Tom Hanks and Tim Allen, who are, with the greatest respect, not on the same level. Ed Asner, obviously an incredible career, but again, he's not a marquee name to most kids who are going to go and see Up.
I don't know. I'd love to see. Would you not go and see an Ed Asner, Christopher Plummer double bill?
Oh, I mean, I would, but I wonder if I was a 7-year-old, if I would drag my parents to that movie. Do you know what I mean? It's not like, what I'm saying is they're not going for the obvious A-list cast, they're going for characters.
Yes. Whereas DreamWorks, especially in the early days,
went for those A-listers.
Like,
But which is why I would choose Kung Fu Panda.
Is a good answer.
Jack Black, Dustin Hoffman,
Jackie Chan,
Angelina Jolie, Bryan Cranston, J.K. Simmons.
Now, wait a second. You say Kung Fu Panda.
I'm saying three. Kung Fu Panda 3 is actually what I'm picking out of at this
point. I'm going to raise you with Madagascar 3.
Okay.
So then that has Chris Rock, Ben Stiller, Jessica Chastain, Jada Pinkett Smith, David Schwimmer, the aforementioned Bryan Cranston, Sacha Baron Cohen, and also it's a brilliant film.
It is better than two.
It's hilarious. Because I'm also going to rule out Western adaptations of things like Studio Ghibli movies. So because they've got really good casts.
They have got really good. Ooh, so Howl's Moving Castle. Christian Talk Bale, the cast. Billy Crystal, and Emily Mortimer?
Bluntie Mortimer.
It's one of the Emily's Emmas that I get mixed up. I think it's Emily
Watson?
Mortimer.
Emily Mortimer.
Or Watson.
It's Emily Mortimer. I've had 3 hours
sleep. I had four.
And we're going to see Endgame again after this, aren't we?
Yeah,
so
we
that's
are.
Going to be fun. But in 4DX,
woo!
Which I've never done before. I've never done the 4DX. Have you done 4DX?
No, hell no. Well, I did the thing at the, the thing at Madame Tussauds? There's a Marvel animation at Madame Tussauds, and it's 4DX-y type. Like, it pokes you in the back, and then it squirts water in your face.
Hang on, we talking about the dildos again?
And it blows air. It was really... frankly, what? Uncomfortable, unpleasant, and I hated every second of it. So
does
I don't
he get
know
those
if that's the same as 4DX.
Well, I've done that kind of 4DX at, I don't know, Disney or Universal or one of those places. The ones that I've done in like normal cinemas have been a little bit less upsetting, basically.
What do they do? They vibrate and they...
Yeah, so you get like the impression of like being in a moving truck or helicopter or whatever. And I remember when somebody got shot, there were sort of little pings in your back. So you could kind of feel the bullets go past almost. But it makes no sense from a story perspective. Like, let's be honest, it is 100% gimmick.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it was very entertaining.
I find it just, it would be distracting when I'm trying to watch the film.
I mean, it is at first, and then you kind of sink into it, as it were.
Yeah. Okay.
Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse has got a pretty
decent
cast that I would like to see in live action. So Shameik Moore and Hailee Steinfeld, she's in it as well. And... we've got Nicolas Cage.
Brian Tyree Henry, Mahershala Ali.
Oh my God.
Chris Pine.
It's so good.
It's so good. Oh,
it's so good.
John Mulaney. Oh, that'd be so good.
So maybe that one?
Yes, I would actually 100% watch those people in a movie.
This isn't supposing an adaptation of these movies.
This
is supposing a completely different film that just happens to have the same cast.
Yes, exactly.
So for example, let's take Spotlight and remake it and recast it with these people. Does that work?
Oh my God.
Or Reservoir Dogs, you know, or great ensemble movies, right?
Right.
Okay, all right. Glengarry, Glen Ross.
Right.
Who do you cast? Take the cast of Madagascar 3 and cast Glengarry, Glen Ross. Do it now.
Oh, come on.
You got Cranston.
Well, he'd...
Cranston right away.
He would have to have the Jack Lemmon role.
That's a good choice.
I mean,
that's
I don't choice. See who else
Shelley
could
the Machine
Shelley
Levine.
Shelley the Machine Levine, yeah. Sacha Baron Cohen would be Alec Baldwin.
With the always be closing
always
speech,
be closing.
You
yeah.
think that would be Sacha Baron Cohen?
I mean, who else do you have
I'm
in Madagascar 3?
Round.
Okay, bring it.
Jessica Chastain.
Ooh, that would be good, actually. Okay.
You know what you need to sell real estate?
Yeah.
You need brass balls to sell real estate.
And
imagine
we know,
her doing that speech.
And we know from the 3-star film Molly's Game that she looks great in a suit.
All right, you've gone
Can
there.
Can open, worms
fine,
everywhere.
Fine, if you're going to say that, and since we're talking about animated movies, I need to take both of you to task over something.
Oh, God.
I watched Teen Titans Go to the Movies.
Oh, no.
It is not good.
It is so
good. It is
good.
Not
so funny,
and it is not entertaining.
Yes, but you're the enemy
what
of fun.
What are you like?
You are a Burke.
Like, you raved about that so much. It's the greatest it's superhero movie of the year. It's
brilliant.
Amazing, and it's just like, oh my God, what a snooze fest.
Well, it's not the greatest superhero movie of the year, because in that year we obviously had Black Panther, Infinity War, and Spider-Man
and the
Spider-Verse.
And of course, Ant-Man and the Wasp, the true number one film
of
the year.
Oh, God, speaking of 3-star films.
Hello. That we can agree on. But Teen Titans is hilarious. hilarious.
Yeah.
How did you not love it?
If you're six.
Yeah, we are.
Teen Titans is amazing. The gag rate is phenomenal. And you, my friend.
I did not even smile.
Of course you didn't.
James, I've known you for years. You're one of my best friends, but you are rancid scum. You really are.
That seems fair. Okay. I'm never watching that film again.
Great.
And you should both be shot.
Back
but
to Glengarry Glen Ross.
Hurrah.
All right, so we got the Jack Lemmon role is Bryan Cranston.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So we got the Alec Baldwin role.
Yep.
That's Jessica Chastain.
Yep.
Right, so we got Ricky Roma. We got Al Pacino.
Yep.
Who is Al Pacino?
I mean, the obvious one would be Ben Stiller to me.
That's what I'm thinking.
I mean, can we mix it up, though? Is there a Chris Rock?
I don't know if Chris Rock. I don't know if Chris Rock plays that role.
I don't know if he's got the energy for it.
I think he
plays the right energy.
Oh, you know what? Actually, though, that might work. That might work because the Ed Harris role, Dave Moss, there's a lot of anger in there.
Yes.
And who would you get? Mr. Furious. So Ben Stiller plays that role.
Wow.
Chris Rock is Ricky Roma.
Mystery Men callback there.
Hello.
Not every day you get one of those.
And who else is in this movie? So Sacha Baron Cohen. I think he would be good in the Jonathan Pryce role of the sort of beleaguered client who is a bit in over his head. So that leaves two roles. It leaves Alan Arkin, who is the put-upon salesman, George, and then Kevin Spacey, the dickhead office manager.
Mm.
Who do you cast in that role?
Jada Pinkett Smith is not put-upon, so
no,
she
she's
would
not.
Have to be...
But then
the dickhead, but that seems, I mean, which is actually, also out of
could,
character, but
she
I
could
think
be
she
a,
could do it.
Schwimmer will be a perfect. Schwimmer is a perfect Alan Arkin, which means that Jada Pinkett Smith has to play the Kevin Spacey role.
Although, I will say, Schwimmer can be a great dickhead. Like, I was just rewatching Band of Brothers recently.
You don't even need to watch that. Just rewatch Friends.
Well, come on.
Dickhead to the max. Ross is a dickhead.
Ross is not
I'm sorry.
A dickhead.
I'm here to break it to you. Ross is a dickhead. Phoebe is a terrible human being, but I love
dreadful.
Them.
Phoebe is dreadful.
And as Hugh Laurie says to Jennifer Aniston's Rachel on the plane when she's flying over to try and destroy Ross's marriage, you are a terrible person. And she is.
I mean, she literally abandons her child in the final episode. She's about to fly off and she's forgotten she has a daughter. There's no sense of where she is or who has her or whether she's accompanying her mother abroad.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Anyway, so if someone can make that Glengarry Glen Ross happen, that'd be amazing. next week, we'll be recasting Madagascar 3 with the cast of Glengarry Glen Ross.
Would watch.
Might be problematic because of him and Mathy, but, you know, it's totally fine.
And also Jack Lemmon.
Jack Lemmon's not problematic.
He's not problematic, but he is unfortunately deceased.
No, it's an animated movie.
Okay.
Oh, you know who does a really good Jack Lemmon impression? Kenneth Mayne.
Oh, God.
If you want to have your question read out in the Empire podcast and treat it with the respect it deserves, as I am Gal Incognito, found to their cost, then you can get in touch with us via a number of methods. We're on the Twitters as at Empire Magazine. Use the hashtag Empire Podcast. We're on Facebook as well as Empire Magazine, and we're on email. podcast@empireonline.com. And going from COM to OMG, because it's time to talk about this week's movie news. And we should start with the news that Avengers Endgame has done pretty well at the box office. It's done all right at the box office.
Well.
You know, average.
Everyone's now rushing to find out just how well it's done.
It was 1.2 billion over the weekend, and there was some speculation that Disney was actually lowballing those early figures. I'll be honest, I haven't checked back since because I'm still reeling from that figure. But that is not just the best opening weekend ever, but it's the best by a considerable distance.
Yes, indeed.
Almost doubling, I think, its own next competitor.
Yeah, the $1.2 billion global debut of Avengers Endgame is, you know, anyone who listens to the podcast and has been a long-term listener to the podcast will know I'm a bit of a box office geek. And if I'm honest, I didn't think I would ever see this. Maybe ever is a strong word, but I didn't think I'd see this sort of opening for a long, long time. It smashed pretty much every record that was there to smash. It broke Infinity War's record for the biggest opening of all time in the States, which was $257 million a year ago. It broke up by $100 million.
Yeah.
This is a three-hour movie.
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of incredible. It broke the global record, as Helen said. It doubled it.
Pretty much, yeah. It was 680 or something.
Mm-hmm.
So
the question is now, as you say, you are a box office nerd. If you had to Groundhog Day this, if you had to prognosticate, where do you think this will end up?
Okay, this is a big
question. Well, it all depends on the multiple, James. So you want to multiply your opening weekend by up to three. Pretty much nobody goes beyond that unless you have incredibly long legs, which we don't expect for a film that is this front-loaded.
Oh, the Giant Man has long legs.
He
Thanks,
does.
Chris. Thanks for adding that. So the worst multiple in the MCU is something like 2.7 or something for Captain America the First Avenger. Assuming it's a bit more than that, you are looking at a challenge to Avatar.
Genuinely, I did not think that I would see Avatar challenged at the box office for a number of years. And so put it in context, Avatar is the number one film of all time with 2.7 billion. Just over 2.7 billion, in fact. And that is streets ahead of its of the number two, which is Titanic. Then at the moment, it's Force Awakens. Then it's Infinity War. At the end of this weekend, even if this movie drops 60 to 65%, which is not inconceivable given how many people saw it in the first weekend and the need to see, and that might have been sated by the second weekend. If it drops around 60, 65%, it'll still have a second weekend of 500 million thereabouts, which will put it already past Force Awakens and Infinity War in 10 days.
Yeah.
Which is incredible.
And actually, and Infinity War had a lower drop-off than that.
Yeah.
With a similarly, you know, impressive opening, we thought, at the time. So it is entirely possible that it won't be a 60 or some so percent drop-off. It'll be less.
It might be less. You never know. You never know. People might be going back for that hot giant man action. You you just don't know. So quite honestly, I think this thing goes past Avatar.
Really?
Yeah.
It's pretty much...
I wouldn't be surprised if it goes past Titanic. Yeah, I'd be astonished if it goes past Avatar. But,
I think it'll be within about 200 to 300 million of Avatar.
And that's incredible in and of itself.
Yeah. I mean, it's currently at 1.48. So it's definitely going to be number two all time. It's apparently top 10 all time adjusted for inflation and ticket pricing, which is unbelievable, given the numbers of people who went over the years, over decades as well, of re-releases to things like Gone with the Wind and Snow White. It is going to be top 10 of all time adjusted, which is amazing.
So this has obviously been a blur of numbers for anyone who's not in the box office. So let's talk about the significance of this movie and why we think it has done what it's done. Because this is incredible. I genuinely did not think we would see an opening this big, and I'm not sure we will for a long, long time. Cut to The Rise of Skywalker.
But it's not, but again, it taps into kind of what Avatar was, isn't it? It's not a film so much as a cinematic event, a cultural landmark in many ways. Avatar was partly because it was Return of James Cameron, but more that it was the technical achievement and it was the, God help us, the reinvention of 3D.
But Avatar was completely different because Avatar didn't open to these numbers. Avatar was...
No, Avatar was all repeat viewing.
It had the long legs.
Incredible longevity. Yeah. Yes, that's exactly what it is.
And it didn't have Giant Man, to be clear.
No, it didn't have Giant Man.
It does, though,
just
have great Leonoptrix.
It does.
That's true.
It does. Yeah, it's just, and the question here will be this, which has peaked very, very early, or spiked very, very early, how long it's that sustainable.
That's the thing, because these numbers are unprecedented, so there's every chance, you know, it might drop 50%, it might drop 80%, we don't know.
But it might not.
No, I suspect it'll drop like a big blockbuster normally drops, which is 50-60%.
Yeah.
So if that happens, quite honestly, Avatar's toast. Hemsworth, I don't know if you saw Hemsworth on Instagram the other day, did a post thanking the fans for the biggest opening weekend of all time, and he said, "We're on our way to being the biggest movie of all time." And I was like, "Hold your horses there, Hemsworth. He speaketh too soon." I don't think he does. I think this thing is going to outstrip Avatar.
It would be a more impressive achievement than Avatar, because Avatar's reason for hitting those numbers was partly due to the fact that 3D tickets cost more money, partly due to the fact that people went back to see it because 3D was a gimmick and it was exciting and it was new before other filmmakers ruined 3D. Whereas this is just, it's succeeding on its own merits. Like, if it makes that amount of money, it's because people want to see this film for what it is.
Well, yeah, it's succeeding on the merits of 20 films before
it
as well.
It is an event. And you know, love Marvel, hate Marvel, but this 22 film arc is something the likes of which has never been before.
Yeah.
Like, it's an incredible achievement.
Yeah.
And this is an incredibly satisfying ending to it. So, I mean, we're all freaks. We've all seen it multiple times. But we're not the only freaks out there. There are a lot of other freaks all watching this multiple times.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just in this reality.
But it feels different to me. You know, we've all lived through phenomenons, cinematic phenomenons. We've all lived through things like The Force Awakens doing incredibly well, and Black Panther doing incredibly well. And, you know, over here, the Bond films are, I think Skyfall, I think, is still the number one film of all time in this country.
I mean, Helen watches them many, many times.
So often. Yeah.
That was down to Helen, just repeat business.
I just can't get enough of James Bond, was it? Bond, yes.
You know, and...
I think it'll beat Skyfall as well.
You think?
Yeah, it opened to what, 42 over here?
I'm not aware of that information.
It's something like 42, 43, so, and it was about 100 for Skyfall, if memory serves. So.
Yeah, something like that.
It's got a good chance, at the very least.
But, for example, I was trying to see it in IMAX the other day, And so the only screening I could go to was 9 a.m. Wednesday. And I looked at, this is 9 a.m. Wednesday screening, and it was pretty much sold out. And the only seats left were the seats that give you a crick in your neck. So I just went, nah, screw it. But that, to me, was indicative of what a cultural event this is. Mm.
What I think's also good is that not only are we doing a live Endgame podcast on Saturday and an Endgame spoiler special, and we reviewed it last week, but we've now spent at least 15 minutes talking about it again. It's taking over the entire podcast.
All right, should we move on to some other stuff then?
Absolutely not.
But we should mention as well that our live Endgame spoiler special has now sold out.
So it's the dildos that did it.
Very, very excited to see you guys there on Saturday night at King's Place. There may be returns available at the box office. So if you are in London on Saturday night, Star Wars Day, may the 4th be with you, then may the 4th be with us. And just maybe pop down to King's Place around 7 o'clock and there might be returns available on the door. You never know. And yes, our in-studio Avengers Endgame spoiler special. We haven't been able to record it until now because of all sorts of stuff. But we are going to record it today, as you're listening to this, Friday. And it'll be up, my sleep levels notwithstanding, it'll be up probably Sunday the 5th of May. So look out for that then. And then, as I said last week, we're holding back the spoiler special interviews with the Russo brothers and Marcus McFeely, the writers, until later in the month. But I understand that they may have done one or two other interviews elsewhere. You can seek those out if you want. They won't be as good as ours. They just won't. I mean, they might be better, objectively speaking, but I refuse to acknowledge them. Wow. But there you go.
That's so generous of you, Chris.
I have.
Wow, so magnanimous.
I like to rise above it, you know? Mm-hmm. So there you go. And let's move on to talk about something else.
Yes. Can we talk about the most important film news, well, TV news of the week?
Sonic
the
Hedgehog. Ross.
No.
It's been rebooted with the cast of Madagascar 3.
No.
Damn it.
It's news that is my sun, my moon, my starlit sky. I live in darkness without.
What's happening?
Willow, the TV series.
Oh, no.
Yes. Ron Howard and John Kasdan are working on a TV series of Willow. You know, the Warwick Davis movie from
yes.
the 80s?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, I mean...
1988, directed by Ron Howard.
Thank you. Val Kilmer's best role, I think we can all agree.
Get the hell out of town.
That's true. Mad Mardigan.
Get out. For life, baby.
Nick Rivers... FTW, Gay Perry, also FTW. And
and Mad Mardigan,
no,
FTW.
Rubbish. I'm not a Willow fan, by the way. I don't know if that's come across.
I don't know. I love it. I think it's great. And I would like to see Warwick Davis play that character again. So I am here for it. And I hope that Disney uses the sacks of cash they now apparently have and just throws them at the original cast to get them back.
Uh-huh. They're all too old. What are you talking about?
I don't care. It's a sequel. Kind of thing further down the line. There's no such thing as too old, you ageist. I also love that this apparently came about via pester power that John Kasdan kept on at Ron Howard while they were working on Solo, going, no, but make something with Willow, bring back Willow, and just like completely pestered him into making this show. I just think
if I make Willow,
hilarious.
Will you go away? Will you leave me alone?
Please stop following me home every night.
Can we for a moment
no.
talk about Sonic the Hedgehog?
Oh, must we?
Did you watch the trailer?
I did.
Were you as upset by it as I was?
No, because I never played the game and I don't care.
It doesn't matter. Like, you don't even have to have seen the game. It's freaky and upsetting.
Yeah, it's freaky and upsetting, but I imagine I wasn't as upset is what I'm saying because I don't have any connection to Sonic.
Words fail me, but it's not hashtag not my Sonic. I can't be dealing with that. The anthropomorphized look of that hedgehog, I mean... faster-than-light hedgehog thing that pretends to be Quicksilver. I just, no. And I mean, I'm not even sure the tone they're going for. So they've taken him, they've uncaricatured him. They've made him look, quote-unquote, realistic.
Uh-huh.
And yet, because he's much more sort of like super deformed, like large head, small body, you know, he's much more cartoony. Yeah. And they've stretched him out and made him look a bit like a real human-sized blue mutant hedgehog.
He looks a little bit, what's the word I'm looking for? Unfinished.
You think?
Yeah, well, they've got the work experience guy on it.
That may be true.
One of the two.
Well, someone on the internet, because the internet, reimagined their Sonic looking a little bit more, you know, caricatured. And it looks a lot better. Like, I would have definitely gone that route. But they didn't ask me. I don't
understand. So weird. What did you think of, you know, James Marsden looks like he's going to be the put upon every man.
Cyclops,
thing.
What are you doing?
I know. And then what about Jim Carrey? Oy. I don't know the character. I don't know anything about him.
I mean, it's not much to know. It's Dr. Robotnik. Eggman.
And it doesn't matter what the character is, yeah, because really it's Jim Carrey.
Jim Carrey being Jim Carrey.
Doing his Jim Carrey thing.
Exactly that.
Which, in fairness, we haven't seen for a long time.
Yeah, exactly.
No, we haven't. Yeah, like he's not been like crazy wacky Jim for ages.
Yeah.
So that was quite interesting.
So someone's saying this is like a sort of return to the 90s. This is a bit of a callback, you know, in that you have Sonic and you have Jim Carrey and they're both 90s in a way. So nostalgia?
I wanted to see Knuckles the Echidna.
I see. I don't. Sonic the Hedgehog passed me by so damn fast. But I, as you know, I'm not a gamer. I play one game and one game only.
Is that
and
FIFA?
That is FIFA. And where's that adaptation?
You know, I only play one game too.
Which is?
Free Cell.
The game of life.
That's the game I play, yes. Okay. Definitely life, not Free Cell. I've stopped playing Free Cell.
Free Cell, is that still a thing?
I don't know. It comes as standard on PCs.
Does it still?
I don't know. I've stopped playing it. I had to stop playing it.
You don't play any other game?
Free Cell's just solitaire, isn't it?
It's a form of solitaire, but it's a much better one than solitaire because you can always win. So you get obsessed with playing the same game over and over again until you win because there is always a way to win. Except for there's rumors of like there's one, you know, format of cards that you can't win, but there's like 36 million games, so there's one apparently.
You're absolutely right, Helen. This sounds far better than World of Warcraft.
I know, right? This is why I don't play the actually addictive ones.
Did you ever play Minesweeper? Do you remember Minesweeper?
My dad is addicted to that.
This is no horror curse, isn't it?
We're a really
shit-free Windows games.
We're a pretty radical family in our game playing.
Clearly.
Trivial Pursuit, that's my game.
That's a great game, isn't it?
Yes.
Trivial Pursuit taught me that hedgehogs masturbate. One of the questions was, do hedgehogs masturbate?
No, it wasn't.
Yes, it was.
No, it wasn't.
Yes, it was. Do hedgehogs masturbate? And it's a yes or no answer, right? And you have to go, well, it's obviously going to be yes, because that's, otherwise, what's that question doing here? It may have been the Yellow Genus 2 edition. Do hedgehogs masturbate? Yes.
I don't believe this is a true thing. Either in reality or that it was in that game. I feel this is like one of these things
where you've
mixed up your own weird fantasy life with reality again.
What? I've been writing some more Sonic the Hedgehog slash fiction again. So maybe that could be something he does in the movie.
Perhaps. But he'd do it so quickly, it'd be over very fast.
Oh, I feel seen. This is a very rude episode of the Empire Podcast,
isn't it?
It's
all gone wrong.
Should we talk about Quentin Tarantino's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood?
Because we can.
Yes, because it is going to the Cannes Film Festival. QT has been locked up in an editing suite for the last few months, trying to get it done in time to premiere at Cannes, because that's kind of his thing.
Yeah, it's not really a surprise, is it? I mean, the rumours when they said there were more films to be announced were immediately, oh yes, and that'll probably be Tarantino, assuming he finishes in time. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, seems reasonable. He's one of their favourites, isn't he? He's always going to be invited there if he has a film to show.
And it's in competition as well, which is interesting. So, yeah, I'm very excited about this one. 2 hours and 45 minutes, apparently.
Oh, a veritable snip by his standards. My goodness.
I'm excited. I'm very excited. There's been some casting news this week for The Suicide Squad, which is James Gunn's next movie. Of course, it is a soft reboot, which apparently is a phrase, of Suicide Squad, which was
a mess.
A film.
Just a horror show, wasn't it, really? But anyway, James Gunn is writing and directing the sequel, and this week he's added David Dastmalchian to the cast as Polka Dot Man. And also Daniela Melchior, who's a newcomer, has joined the cast as Ratcatcher, who is normally a Batman bad guy with the emphasis on guy, but it looks like Gunn is flipping the gender of the character, and Ratcatcher can control rats. And Polka Dot Man, I must admit, I'm not au fait with the comics, but Polka Dot Man apparently wears a suit that is covered in polka dots.
It's Mr.
And
Blobby.
Polka dots can be, yes,
it's Mr. Blobby. Blobby.
David Dastmalchian, who, I don't know if you guys remember, but last week I was telling you about my experiences at the Avengers Endgame world premiere.
Oh, God.
When I was sitting just across from my good friend Lawrence Larry Fish Fishburne, and David Dastmalchian, a.k.a. Kurt from the Ant-Man movies, and the weird creepy guy in The Dark Knight, and now, of course, Polka Dot Man in The Suicide Squad.
Yeah, so really his second DC character in a way.
Yeah, I like to think they were friends, and I'll hopefully get on set on that one.
Sure.
Just to hang out with him.
Well, of course, that'll be an interesting set in the sense that the director will be making another film really before the film comes out. Right?
Yeah.
So Guardians of the Galaxy, as Naibun introduced it, will be shooting in 2020 and Suicide Squad is due out in August 2021. So that means James Gunn is going to have some exceptional time management issues to work out. I mean, he seems like an organized guy. You know, he seems like he has stuff sort of under control, he will need to. That's a heck of a lot of work for the next 2 years.
Yep, he will definitely need to exercise some gun control over the next 2 years.
There's a message for you there, America.
Yeah, listen to the Empire podcast. Yeah, this is very interesting. Not unprecedented, of course. Yeah. You know, I believe, what was it? Guy Ritchie was making another film whilst The Man from U.N.C.L.E. was still being finished.
King Arthur?
King Arthur, yeah. Mm-hmm. And of course, if you want an example of filmmakers making movies whilst making other movies, then Steven Spielberg is the one made Schindler's List whilst doing post-production on Jurassic Park. Yeah. And that's kind of incredible.
And signing off episodes of Animaniacs, apparently.
I mean, that's
the
important thing, right?
I genuinely think that's important to know, that he was watching Animaniacs at the same time.
And not sleeping.
Presumably not. Yeah. But yeah.
But, you know, I am looking forward to the Suicide Squad. Gunn took to Instagram this week. Did you see this? That he took to Instagram and posted a photograph of his own personal Suicide Squad comic book collection. And I think it's perhaps to head off cynics like, oh, I don't know, me and others who have maybe gone,
hello,
well, that was just a gig that he took when he was fired from Guardians 3. And maybe it might not mean as much to him as Guardians, but he's clearly going, no, I really like the Suicide Squad comic books and I really want to make this movie, which is why I'm still making the movie, and then I'll segue into Guardians 3. Listen, you know our feelings on Suicide Squad, but hopefully the Suicide Squad will be fantastic and hopefully we'll get two great movies from James Gunn within a few months of each other, I guess.
He certainly knows how to handle an ensemble of weirdos and creeps and odd people, so I think it could work really, really well for a Suicide Squad.
So do I.
And if the Suicide Squad is R-rated, and also if he's filling it with a really interesting cast and goes kind of full Dirty Dozen, which is what the David Ayer movie didn't really do, in that none of them were expendable, really. So maybe if you go full Dirty Dozen and you actually do begin to work through your cast, and you can have some interesting heroic deaths and whatnot.
Polka Dot Man, definitely dying.
Polka Dot Man is a guy.
Yeah, he's fucked.
No, he's going to be the breakout star who becomes the leader of the Suicide Squad too.
Well, I hope so, because my good friend David Dast Malkian, I'm just so excited to see him finally breaking through after all these years.
Here's some news for you.
Yeah, okay.
We are halfway through the final season of Game of Thrones.
Yeah, we are.
That is a hell of a thing.
Yeah, it is. We can't talk about it, can we?
We can't talk about it in detail, but we don't need to, Helen. Do you know why? Because every week on the Pilot TV podcast, we do a special Game of Thrones spoiler special at the end of the episode where we break down the latest episode in minute throne-splaining detail.
That sounds great. Can't wait for that.
Oh, it's going to be amazing.
What do you think is going to happen?
Well, you know, loads of stuff.
Dragons.
Cersei, dragons, things, people, death, mourning, you know, it's going to be great.
So Chris McQuarrie has been talking about the 7th and 8th Mission Impossible movies, and as fate would have it, he was talking about them to me, and Empire magazine.
Yay!
Right. Okay, so shameless plug. On the cover of the new issue of Empire is John Wick Chapter 3, Parabellum, and McQuarrie can be found. There's a big old piece about McQuarrie. He is one of our 30 filmmakers we have chosen for our 30th anniversary, hashtag Empire 30. And there's a big old article there talking about his evolution as an action director and how he's changed the game for mainstream action filmmaking in the last few years, going through all his movies, including Way of the Gun. As part of that conversation, I also spoke to the likes of, oh, what's that fella called? Maypother. Cruzy Maypother, that guy. Tom Cruise.
Oh,
Tom
Cruise.
I spoke to Tom Cruise and Simon Pegg and some key collaborators of McQuarrie's as well, his editor Eddie Hamilton, one of his cinematographers, Robert Elswit, people like that. So it's a really interesting article. But as part of that, we spoke a little bit about the 7th and 8th Mission Impossible movies and his plans for them. And while he wouldn't go into specifics, he did say that he was looking forward to, but also daunted by the challenge, and that they had basically pitched two movies and now they have to justify two movies. And so they're in the planning stages for those. And it's going to be really fascinating to see what they can do. And we talked a little bit about what you can do with Tom in the next one, what you can make him fall off or climb up. And, you know, he said, you know, falling from the moon is difficult. It's impossible because of the gravity and all sorts of stuff.
He's just not trying hard enough.
He really needs to pull his finger out, quite frankly.
Yeah.
So you can pick up the new issue. It is on sale right now. I wrote some of it, so apologies for that.
What did you write, Chris?
I wrote the McQuarrie stuff, and I wrote a piece about Rocket Man as well, because I thought it was a sci-fi film. It was only when I got on set that I realized it was a drama about Elton John.
How embarrassing.
By then, it was too late, so I had to write about it. You know,
my understanding is the whole film is a dramatization of that scene between Tony Todd and Nick Cage in The Rock.
Yes.
You're
yes, it.
You're the Rocket Man.
That's
yes, it is. No, I'm very excited about Rocket Man. I've seen some footage. I think it looks tremendous. So fingers crossed indeed for that one. And there's loads of other great stuff aside the issue as well. It's available right now in all good and evil newsagents. Tell them Empire sent you and you get a 0% discount.
Wait, do we want to tell the evil newsagents that we're sending people to them? Like, might that lead the evil newsagents to trace us back to us?
It's possible you're overthinking this.
Possible.
What would an evil newsagent be?
They'd be missing pages from the paper.
All the porn mags are on the bottom to make it easier to get them.
Oh, that'd be awful. And what, the kids' mags at the top?
Yeah, and the Mars bars are behind the counter. The cigarettes are out front.
Oh, I see.
You see what I mean?
Only stock total film, you know, that kind of thing.
What's that?
Total, something.
Total film?
Yeah.
Never heard of it.
No?
Hey, we should launch a film magazine back home.
That's a great idea.
Called Total Film.
With a U.
Yes. All the films that are out this month.
So many films.
Well, because it's Northern
well,
Ireland.
Well, like three films.
Two films. Both of them have got Adrian Dunbar.
That's no bad thing.
No bad thing.
No bad thing.
He's great. Hear my song. Nicholas Holt and Tyler Perry this week joined the cast of Taylor Sheridan's next movie, Those Who Wish Me Dead, which I'm very, very excited about. This is about a teenager. It's a bit like Witness. It sounds like Witness to me, like a teenager who witnesses a murder and has moved into the Witness Protection Program up in the Montana wilderness. Uh-huh. And two trained killers come after him. Now, Angelina Jolie is also in the film. And we think that she might be playing the boy's mother. And we think that Nicholas Holt might be playing one of the killers. Now, I spoke to Nicholas Holt for this week's podcast, and you'll hear that in a few minutes. And we talked a little bit about the film, but I didn't want to go into specifics because, well, he clearly didn't want to share specifics because he's literally just signed on to the movie. But I'm very excited about this. This is Taylor Sheridan's second directorial outing after Wind River. So, yeah, excited.
Yeah, sounds good.
Sounds great to me. And we're going to finish off with some very, very sad news this week. The John Singleton, the director of Boys in the Hood and Too Fast, Too Furious and Poetic Justice and the 2000 reboot / sequel of Shaft, died this week at the age of just 51. He had suffered a massive stroke recently, and after much deliberation, his family decided to turn his life support systems off, which is obviously not an easy decision to make. Yeah. And there's been an outpouring of love for Singleton, who was a bit of a trailblazer and a bit of a trendsetter for African-American filmmakers. His first film was Boys in the Hood. And
hell of a
he
debut.
Was yeah. nominated for Best Director at the Oscars for that at the age of 23, which I believe is still a record.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, I think it's probably fair to say that his career didn't go in the direction that he wanted. And I'm sure there's all sorts of reasons for that. Black filmmakers find it very, very hard in Hollywood, especially around the time Singleton was breaking mm-hmm. through. So I imagine the projects coming his way were not ideal. And his next film after that was Poetic Justice with Janet Jackson, which believe is still her only starring role in the movie. That's a really good film, that.
Mm. With Tupac as well. Amazing
yes,
cast.
That's right.
And
that's
Regina
right.
King as well.
Yeah.
Absolutely fantastic cast.
But it didn't catch on the way Boys in the Hood did. Mm. And so presumably after that, he just found it harder and harder to get opportunities. But then he still made really interesting crowd-pleasing stuff like Too Fast, Too Furious and yep. Shaft. And it's a real shame because he seemed to be working on lots of cool things. Brian Koppelman, who's the co-showrunner and creator of Billions, Singleton directed an episode of Billions. And Singleton had been working in the last few years in TV. And Brian Koppelman said that they'd been working on a pilot together for maybe a show that they were going to try and launch as well. Whenever Singleton died, 51. Wow.
It's no age at all. Yeah. It is really sad. I think you're right. I don't think he had the opportunities. I think that maybe I would hope that African-American filmmakers coming through now who had the same sort of career path as he had, or certainly start to his career, would have way more opportunities open to them. And I think a lot of that is down to him, and a lot of that is down to the fact that, you know, he was kind of there first. So yeah, it's such a young age to go, and especially with someone who might just have been sort of finding his feet again.
It's a lovely tribute from Ice Cube about this, who obviously credited Singleton with making him a movie star,
yeah.
you know, to elevating him to that position. He'd not done anything before Boys in the Hood, and he's the absolute standout in that
he's
film.
He's stunning in that film.
Incredible.
I also really enjoyed, this is a strange recommendation, but I also really enjoyed Four Brothers. If you haven't seen that, that's a really solid thriller also. I mean, it's not much more to say other than it's just a tremendous, tremendous shame. But if you want to go back and dig into his filmography, there's loads of stuff there beside Boys in the Hood.
Yeah, but do start with that. If you haven't seen
it. But do start with that, yes.
If you haven't seen it, do yourself a massive favour and watch it.
Absolutely. John Singleton, who passed away this week at the age of just 51. Okay, just a quick addendum now to the news section. We are back in the studio the morning after we recorded the podcast, the main podcast, because some news happened overnight that we need to react to and we want to react to. Very, very sad news in one case. We should start with the disclosure overnight that the director of the Sonic the Hedgehog movie, Jeff Fowler, took to Twitter last night and said that they have heard people's concerns about the design of Sonic the Hedgehog, which obviously we were talking about in the main podcast, and that they're going to address them. They're going to change the design of Sonic the Hedgehog for the Sonic the Hedgehog movie. So they have about 5 months to do so. And people power, I guess, but also, why didn't they get it right in the first place?
I mean, absolutely. There was kind of no excuse for putting it out the way it did. It looked not just terrible, but also just upsetting, as we said before. And I think they probably will go down the more caricatured route now and keep it slightly closer to the Sonic people are familiar with.
I would guess, but sympathies to all the VFX artists who are now going to be working overtime.
Yes.
To try and get this finished, because that's a huge job, I imagine, at this
point. Yeah, and you got to think that they were probably working to a brief, and they're like, we did what you told us to do!
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It won't have been, you know, it's the people who signed off on the design.
Yeah, exactly.
Who obviously have the power
lunatics.
Here.
I tell you, this wouldn't have happened if they'd had Knuckles the Echidna.
So that clearly was the frivolous movie news we wanted to talk about this morning. The serious movie news, very, very sad movie news that happened overnight, is the news that Peter Mayhew, who brought, of course, Chewbacca, my favourite Star Wars character, to life across a series of Star Wars movies right from the off with A New Hope back in 1977, passed away last night at the age of 74. Mm. Very, very sad news indeed.
Yeah, I mean, he was such a huge presence, literally huge presence as Chewbacca, but, you know, there was real kind of warmth to that character, even though he was hidden under all those prosthetics. And, you know, he spent years talking to the fans and being sort of a part of the Star Wars community as well, which he'll be missed for. But he was picked up, he was working as like a hospital orderly or something, wasn't he, when he was picked up to do acting. I think he did a Sinbad film just before Star Wars and then put on the Chewbacca suit, and the rest is kind of history. But yeah, I mean, you know, sometimes one role is all it takes.
Yeah. It's funny to have spent his whole career essentially covered in a suit of yak hair and to have become famous for that. But he gave us a really sort of like memorable physical performance in that. Like, there's so much personality in Chewbacca just from his eyes and the way he cocks his head. Yeah, what would Star Wars have been like without Chewbacca? I hate to think. When I went to Celebration recently, they showed some kind of outtake footage. It was really just rehearsal footage from Star Wars.
Well, you can hear him speaking the lines.
Yeah. And it's him sitting with like Ford and Guinness and Hamill and Fisher in the cockpit of the Falcon. And there were a couple of them actually. And there was the early one where it's the traveling through hyperspace and like Dustin Crop's boy, and they're all laughing at how terrible the dialogue is. And because it was like a read through, he's doing it without the head on, so it's just him with thick black eyeliner. And he's having so much fun, and he looked like he just loved every minute of it.
Oh. Yeah, it's amazing. I love the fact that they write Chewbacca's dialogue in the script and it appears in English. And so there is footage of Mayhew on set
speaking it in English.
Speaking it so the actors know what Chewbacca is saying, so they can react to it accordingly. And those moments are incredible, and they should have just left it in with that sort of thick London-y accent. Mm. I just love Chewbacca. I think that character has so much character and brings so much to Star Wars. Yeah. And it's not just a human fest, then, is it, with Chewie in the background there?
No, he gave a really soulful performance. I think the people identified that Chewbacca wasn't just, you know, a great walking carpet. And I love, do you ever see those ridiculous parody books, those sort of The Force Doth Awaken Shakespearean Star Wars thing? There's a brilliant one for Force Awakens where when Solo dies, you just have Chewie going, "Arr!" And then there's an asterisk by it where they do a trans, and he does this whole iambic pentameter two-page sort of like death soliloquy for Han, and it just the depth of their feelings and relationship. I thought they really summed up the fact that everyone realizes there's a lot more going on beneath the fur. Mm.
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't simply a case of just getting a tall fella and sticking him in a costume.
No.
Otherwise, anyone could have done it.
And I love that he took the time to sort of talk his successor through the character and you know, try and ensure that Chewie would still feel like Chewie.
Yuna Suotamo actually does very good Chewie noises.
He does,
He's surprisingly good at it.
Anyway, we love Chewie and we love Peter Mayhew, and we're very, very sad indeed to hear of his passing. Peter Mayhew, who died aged 74. And now we will return you to our regularly scheduled podcast programming. Okay, time now then for this week's guest. And as I've already mentioned, it is Nicholas Hoult, making a return to the Empire podcast. Fantastic. I was going to say young British actor, but he ain't that anymore, is he? He's over the hill now.
He's quite young.
I mean, he's nearly, what, 30? Oh, Knacker's God. Yard, Helen. But he stars this week as J.R.R. Tolkien in Tolkien, a biopic of J.R.R. Tolkien. And I went along to a London hotel this week to have a chat with him, and we had a good old laugh the morning after the premiere, in fact. So he was nursing some grapefruit juice, and we talked about that. We talked about the upcoming X-Men Dark Phoenix and some other stuff that I've forgotten. But it was a lot of fun. Nicholas Holt. Enjoy. Delighted to be joined on the Abra podcast by the star of Tolkien. Tolkien? What are you saying, Nicholas Holt?
When I got sent the script to this, and I when I saw the front page, if I had read it aloud, I would have said Tolkien.
Yeah.
Because that's what I'd always said throughout my life. And then I did in-depth research for playing the character and realised that I did not know how to pronounce his name.
Yeah.
It's pronounced Tolkien.
Tolkien. We've all been doing it wrong.
Judi Dench
years.
Helped because she did the voiceover for a documentary that I watched.
Okay.
Judi Dench is never wrong. But Tolkien.
Isn't language fluent? Fluid? Fluid?
Apparently not.
No.
It's early.
It's so early, man.
Thanks for joining us this early in the morning.
Well, one of us was at the premiere last night, so I imagine you're in worse shape than I am.
I'm dragging. I'm not going to lie to you. I had to go and do a morning TV show as well, and I set 10, no exaggeration, 10 alarms. I looked at my phone
what?
This morning. I set 10 alarms.
What do you mean, like 10 separate devices?
10 separate alarms, all spaced within 5 minutes. No, all on one device, but was spaced within 5 minute increments.
Nah, that's dangerous.
Of like, you have to be up.
No, nah, that's dangerous.
You cannot not be there.
Because you just press snooze 10 times. Whereas if you have 10 devices and you...
Who has 10 devices that
everyone
they can
has
set
10
alarms
devices.
On?
Okay, so you probably have a phone.
Yeah.
You probably have an iPad, right?
Yeah.
Okay, do you have like some sort of Google Home device type thing? You
no.
can set it on that. Well, you should get one. There you go, that's three.
We're at two.
Set 5 alarms and 2 devices.
It's quite difficult to have 10
sorted.
Devices you can set alarms
it
on,
is.
Isn't it?
I've got about 3 or 4, but I don't want to boast. You know? I don't want to brag. This isn't about me, Nick. This is about you. We're talking Tolkien.
Show off.
All that Empire cash over the years. Those fat stacks of Benjamins that Empire has been sending my way. But anyway, the film Tolkien. So you got the pronunciation. What sort of what other research did you do, or did you just stop at that point? And go. I've seen
it.
Lord of the Rings.
Ultimately, I did that, and I was like, all right, good. Crack on.
I know
roll the cameras.
That's it. Yeah, I'm ready.
What else did we do? It was interesting, actually, because reading the script, I realised that, you know, I was a fan. I got given The Hobbit on the set of About a Boy. The directors gave me that to read. And then I grew up. The movies were huge.
You were in the sweet spot, weren't you? You were about...
I was 13, I think, when the first one came out, something around there. And I was just blown away. Like,
not to brag.
Not to brag. But I was 12 really, or 13. I loved them. Like that Battle of Helm's Deep and stuff. Yeah. I've never seen anything like that in film. And still now, I'm like, when I see it, I'm like blown away by what Peter Jackson did. So yeah, I was a fan. And I played the card game. I stayed behind after school and played the card game as well. And all these sorts of things. And then I realized reading the script, I was like, wow, I know nothing about this man. Which is quite bizarre nowadays, because I feel like I know a lot of things about people that I don't even know who the person is and what they do. But I'm like, oh, I know that they were having dinner there on Tuesday.
Yeah.
And then I was like, well, this is someone who's really like sculpted a mythology that I love and has impacted my life hugely. And I was like, I know nothing about him. So to learn that story behind the story was remarkable. And he had an incredible life. And then in terms of research, yeah, it's a lot of... I mean, later in life, you can find interviews with him and recordings of him. But the period we focus on is formative years up until kind of beginning to write The Hobbit. So it's not like doing an impression where you sit there and you kind of read his work and read his biographies and get all the information you can and then kind of put the puzzle together of what you imagine they might have been like in that time. Look at me. With this goblet of grapefruit juice. I just looked down and I realised how ridiculous this might seem. How un-rock and roll as well. If I was like a cool rock and roll person, this would be wine, red wine
in the
morning.
But it's just, that's it is, for the purposes of this podcast.
Yeah, and, just sitting here.
You've just been mainlining heroin. and some red wine. It's not grapefruit juice, but you brought attention to grapefruit juice. I wasn't going to mention it.
Yeah, I'm drinking, very good for you, grapefruit juice.
I'm drinking water.
Would you like some grapefruit juice?
No, I'm fine. I wouldn't dream of taking a grapefruit juice.
Well, I've forgotten where I was. But yeah, so basically, you learn as much as you can. I would do watercolors, paintings of his work. Yeah, because that was something I didn't realize that he had done.
Yeah.
All the maps and drawings as well. So anything kind of slightly tangible, even if it's not something that on the day to day you're thinking about when you're doing the scene, it's hopefully something that distills through your brain and subconsciously perforates the character somehow.
So you have all your preparation, you get up to day one, you're pretty much ready to rock and roll. But once the cameras start rolling, does that learning process continue? Or are you too wrapped up, in a way, in the filming process to take any more on?
Yeah, it still continues because the script changes and the story that you're telling changes. So you're still learning and developing that. And to be honest with you, I don't think I've ever got to the end of a job and not been like, oh, you know what? It'd be really good to start again because I think I could do it better now. Because you suddenly, you know, it's a moving target in many ways, and everything's out of order, and you finish the job with this new understanding and knowledge where you go, oh,
yeah,
could have probably changed that or done that differently.
And on an X-Men movie, you can do that. You can go back because there will be additional shooting. And
there's normally always reshoots, and you can go back and be like, oh, tweak that and change that. Yeah.
But on Tolkien, you can't do that.
There's not that. No. So I don't know. There's some elements of like you can try and give a variety of takes on the scene that you're doing, so that hopefully in the edit they can, you know. Do we have a happier version? Yeah, no. Take three. He was really happy. But do you know what I mean?
He was looking at the camera in all but one take. So, I mean, directly at the camera.
Yeah.
I don't know what was going on there. There was a bit not to get too much into spoilers by Tolkien. I mean, it is on the
spoiler
internet.
Spoiler alert. We were just talking about Tolkien, spoilers.
But you said this movie does end with him beginning to write The Hobbit.
Yeah.
And is that you writing that at the end? Because we get to see him writing, and the handwriting
is phenomenal, right?
Phenomenal.
It's beautiful. The calligraphy is something.
Yes. Calligraphy, that's a good word.
Yeah.
Was that you making those strokes?
No.
Okay.
No, it was not me. But you know,
bit of movie magic.
It was, we had an artist in to do that because my handwriting is not the best. And you know what? I have actually had calligraphy lessons. We did them for The Favourite, where we'd have a quill and ink and dip it, and it was a lovely experience actually. We all sat there and we had a glass of sake whilst we did it, and I did learn a little bit of it for that, but to make it look film beautiful,
yes,
that's like not something that I could get to the point of doing.
I couldn't help but think that is wonderful calligraphy. That's the word that was running through my head. Calligraphy. That's all I was thinking about. I hadn't forgotten what it was called until you reminded me. And but also, it must have taken him ages to write the book because he was going.
Look how slow he's going. I mean, come on!
It took him 5 minutes to write one word. What's going on?
Yeah.
How the hell did he write The Lord of the Rings?
But the incredible thing about that, him beginning to write The Hobbit, is obviously he'd come invented these languages and worlds and all these things, so they'd been in his mind for a long time. But then the story that I learned, I think this is true, is that basically he was marking tests when he was a professor at Oxford. He was marking tests, and someone had left a blank page on one of their tests, so he was sat there marking, and then was like, blank page, I guess I'll write The Hobbit, is essentially, I guess, how it worked. And it wrote, in a hole in the ground, there lived The Hobbit. And you kind of go, incredible.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
What
do you
how
do?
Lucky that person
yeah.
left a blank page. And they said, who was that? We should know the name of that person.
We should know the name of that person.
They've blessed us all.
Yeah. Dave Bristow, I believe, was the name of that person. Yeah. Dave Bristow of Cheltenham.
Whenever, if I don't really take many tests anymore since leaving school, but if I was to do more tests now, I would leave blank pages purposefully.
But you have loads of downtime on movies
to do tests.
Yeah, you movie types, you're always in your trailers waiting to be called on set.
Yeah, that's,
you know,
true. We do just sit around doing nothing most of the time.
Absolutely, you know. And then the tales of practical jokes and whatnot on the set of the X-Men movies are legendary.
We had a good giggle on X-Men.
Yeah, but you've been wasting your time. You should have been writing The Hobbit too.
I should have been. That's the when you add up all the time that you've wasted doing nothing, you're like, oh, I probably could have done something useful. But sometimes you come up with great things. I've got like lots of videos, lots of dub smashes and like dance videos and things like that, which, you know,
important stuff.
They're not important. Well, they're not important.
That's
very but they important. Are. They make people giggle when I show them.
Yeah, that's it. That's probably all that Tolkien was doing when he was writing The Hobbit. He thought, oh, I'll just make some people giggle. He probably didn't know
They'll love this.
Yeah, he didn't know what was going to happen ultimately. But there is a little bit of, I mean, you know, last week I think the Tolkien family released a statement saying mm-hmm. that they weren't involved with this movie. And what did that mean for you? Did you try to talk to them for research for this, and were the shutters down?
We weren't in contact in the making of the film. I hope when they see it, it's something that they like. I feel like that's kind of a blanket approach to what we're doing, and they've got obviously lots of other things in development and shows and all these sorts of things that they're protective of and whatever else. But foremost as a fan, I feel like we're celebrating his life. It's an incredible story, everything that he went through, and bizarre that we don't all know this story. So I hope they like it when they see it. We were lucky. We had his great grandson Callum came along and shot some of the World War One sequences with us, and he was at the premiere last night, and I think he liked the film. So that was kind of the biggest test for me in some ways. Yeah.
So go back, spread the word to the rest of the Tolkien family.
Yeah.
And tell them, you know.
Maybe they'll like it. Maybe they'll see it and they'll be like, yeah, you know what? And Dome is such a huge fan and has many similarities and understanding in terms of Tolkien's real life that he's the perfect director for it, and so passionate. And I feel like if they got to spend 5 minutes with him, they'd be like, oh, actually, yeah, this makes complete sense that this has been told.
Yeah, some of the World War One imagery, the way that it clearly impacted upon Tolkien, or certainly less the way that it's being presented in this film, is really interesting.
I mean, it, you know, he's quoted as saying that World War One wasn't an allegory for things he created, but of course, even if you're not directly drawing from it, your experiences naturally kind of flow into what you're doing and creating. That is what you draw from. And yeah, this was a really beautiful take on World War One. A beautiful is not the right word, because it's horrific, and the more I learned about that that war and research for this, it was horrifying. But Dome really wanted to. A lot of the images you see from that are black and white kind of propaganda images. So this kind of thing of the reality of what that war was, and then mixing that with Tolkien had trench fever, so this hallucinatory, quite cinematic versions of war, where it's very brutal and real in some elements, but also you get these kind of fantasy twists within it.
Absolutely. No, it's the startling stuff. And just to move on to what you're doing next, it's just been announced you're working with Taylor Sheridan on his next movie.
Yeah, I'm excited about that.
It's called Those Who Wish Me Dead, is that right?
Yeah, Those Who Wish Me Dead. What a title.
It's a fantastic title.
It's cool, right?
Very hard-bitten.
Very hard-bitten?
Yeah, very like noirish, isn't it? You know, Those Who Wish Me Dead.
Yeah, I feel cool saying it. Who Wish Me Dead. Those Who Wish Me Dead. Yeah,
what can you say about that?
I guess not too much.
Because the spoilers.
At this point, because of spoilers.
Does it end with you writing something?
It ends with me writing The Hobbit. Again, that's how everything's going to end from now on. I'm just so excited to work with him. Like Wind River and Sicario and Hell or High Water, some of my favourite films from the last 5-10 years. And I love his storytelling. So I'm excited to see what his process is and be in that world. And I feel like his films are very different from, I don't know, The Favourite and this world, kind of tottering around in heels and a wig. This is going to be a very different thing to jump into, although it seems quite bizarre to be talking about, because we start fairly soon. It's quite bizarre to be sitting talking about it in a hotel room, talking about Tolkien, and then realizing in my head, I'm like, oh, you've got to get ready for that pronto.
I was going to say, how is your prep coming? Are you
not
ready?
Great, because I'm sat here chatting to you.
Oh, it's my fault all of a sudden. So is this what you're saying?
If people are like, you weren't very good in that, I'm going to be like, well, you know why? I was doing the Empire podcast.
We get blamed for so much. It's not my fault. It's not my fault. There's only 15-minute chat, Nick, honestly.
You're ruining cinema.
Sort it out. And then, of course, you've got Dark Phoenix as well.
Yeah.
And that now feels like it may well be the final X-Men movie with you guys in it, at least. What's your feeling about that after all these years?
I feel fortunate to have got, to be a part of it, first of all, because, you know, I grew up with those movies as well. That's the funny thing, like the Lord of the Rings movies and the X-Men movies were the things that I was a real fan of when I was growing up. And the cartoon and all those things. So to get to play that character was truly an honour. But then it was one of those things whereby in this last outing, Simon Kinberg gave really nice place to go with the character. And a new take on it. So that was something whereby if it is the last time that I get to play him, I feel very lucky to have got to push it to that new area and place, as opposed to being like, all right, that's it, your time's up. They're getting someone newer, younger, fresher, better, faster, quicker, and then I watch them, and like, do you know what I mean? I feel like if I'd found out that it was all over, and I felt like I'd just done the same thing for four movies, I'd be like, oh, that's disappointing.
Yeah.
But I feel like throughout those four movies, it's been a real evolution. So, yeah,
there is growth there as well. And also, were you surprised that Beast's arc ends in this movie with him doing dub smashes whilst riding the Hobbit? Was that a surprise for you?
Whilst riding the Hobbit. You know what? I've got some great photos of me like on set of that doing watercolours of Tolkien's work, because I was prepping for that because Tolkien started shooting pretty soon after Dark Phoenix. So I was prepping that whilst like in these action sequences, huge sets. I'd go to like the little beast tent that we have and go and sit in there and like do my Tolkien prep and then go back out and carry on doing my action hero stuff.
In the full beast kit?
Full beast kit, yeah.
Oh my God, I need to see these pictures.
I'm gonna throw them up. I'm going to throw them up on the old gram.
The old gram, fantastic, awesome. Nick, it's been a pleasure as always.
Hey, good to see you, man.
Best luck, cheers, man.
Thank you.
Okay, so that was Nicholas Hoult. And now let's start the reviews section of the show with a long shot, in which Seth Rogen and Charlize Theron get it together.
Spoiler.
I'm guessing.
I mean, it's not unfair from the poster. But yeah, so Seth Rogen is this investigative journalist for a sort of underground paper. He gets laid off because he's just so pure in his anti-corporate stance. His friend takes him out to celebrate and takes him along to this party where he meets the Secretary of State, who is not only Charlize Theron, she's also his former babysitter as a teenager. And she needs a speechwriter as she begins her presidential bid. And he's right there, you know, and he kind of knows her and he kind of knows her voice and knows what she cares about. And, and so one thing leads to another and he joins her staff. So, yeah, I really was not excited about this on the basis of the trailers. I thought they looked super boring and very predictable and like everything I'd seen before. And it's actually kind of delightful. It's a little bit Madam Secretary, obviously, because she's got
you
the same
like
job.
Madam Secretary.
I love Madam Secretary. And you gave up watching it, so you have no right to argue with me.
It's no Designated Survivor, though, is it?
It's better than Designated Survivor. It's not as good as The West Wing. It's in that area.
I mean, what is Helen?
Vast
what
area.
Is?
Well, nothing.
Even the four-star masterpiece that is Molly's Game is not a patch on The West Wing.
No, it's not, because it's three stars. Anyway, there's shades of Madam Secretary there and also shades of sort of a more Seth Rogen-y kind of outrageous comedy kind of stuff. There's a lot of kind of silly physical comedy. There's some bits where it goes a little bit too far and you're like, okay, no Secretary of State would ever allow anything like that to happen anywhere close to them. Like, that's just not a thing. But at the same time, it's kind of entertaining and they're actually really likable together and you can sort of see why this goddess would take up with Seth Rogen. You know, it's sort of, there's a kind of sense to it that kind of was charming to me.
Yeah, I sadly haven't seen Long Shot yet. I missed every single screening because I was in the States. But I've heard good things about this movie.
Yeah.
So, yeah, fingers crossed.
Good work, Jonathan Levine. We mentioned Ice Cube before. This also features O'Shea Jackson Jr., his son, in a nice little supporting role, by the way. So
4 stars?
4 stars.
4 stars then for Long Shot. Incredible. Next up, we have the second film as director of Brady Corbet, former Thunderbird, now turned art house guru. And this is Vox Lux.
It is indeed.
Jimbo.
Yes, this is Vox Lux, which is, of course, Latin for shouting at light bulbs. And stars... No. And stars Brady Corbet, a.k.a. Derek from 24. So all of these are nice things. This is a film of very much of two very distinct halves. It is a film about a singer called Celeste, who is talent spotted while singing at the memorial service for a high school shooting, which happened at a school that she survives. And she's turned into a kind of pop star diva singer songwriter in the sort of Gaga, Britney, Katy Perry type mold. And she's played very, very well by Rafi Cassidy in the first half. And it's got a real art house sensibility to it. It's really, really hard hitting. So it starts with a high school shooting. I went into this blind, not knowing what this film was about. I thought, oh, Vox Lux singers, be like a Star is Born, you know, whatever. You go in, and one of the first things that happens is a teacher gets shot in the chest. Like, it's really, really full on, incredibly powerful opening. And the whole first half, which shows her as a kind of a teenager feeling her way into this business, getting into the music industry, her manager, Jude Law, and sort of meeting up with different people and trying to sort of navigate that world and find her voice, because she sings at this memorial service and becomes a big star, and then she has to try and repeat that. And then the film stops and then starts again. It skips forward 18 years, and Raffi Cassidy is now replaced by Natalie Portman as Celeste, but Raffi Cassidy persists as Celeste's daughter. So she switches roles and becomes her own daughter for the second half. The second half, unfortunately, bored my absolute tits off. No, genuinely, like I felt this felt like a film where the first half of this is like 4 bordering on 5 stars, and the second half of it for me was 3 bordering on 2 stars.
Why?
It's a completely different vibe. Like, it doesn't have that same sensibility. It doesn't have the same power. It doesn't even have the same level of intensity. So it feels like there's a nice affectation in this where Willem Dafoe essentially narrates this in a documentarian way, where he's talking about Celeste and he's explaining periods of her life. And when it picks up 18 years later, she has become big, she's had a big scandal, and now she's on a comeback tour, and her comeback album is Vox Lux. And he talks about periods in her life which sound far more interesting than what we actually see. So it feels like he's narrating a better film, which is somehow happening off camera. And actually, you just get to see her being a right stroppy twat and just being horrible to people and shouting at people in diners and being a terrible mother and just being a terrible person. And you're waiting for it to come to a point, because she is a star that was born out of violence. And there is a plot point in the second half where she seems to almost lead to violence as well. And it doesn't feel like those threads are properly drawn together. And by the end of the film, you're not quite sure what the point of the film was. So it absolutely had me hooked for the first half, absolutely lost me in the second half. However, I will say that this is a film that seems to, like, its structure kind of has split people. Like, it's had some very positive reviews. Mm. Ian Freer, who reviewed it for us, very much enjoyed it.
Yes, he did.
He did have, I think, the same issues that I did, but they didn't bother him as much. He thought
Ian
this
is
was
generous and kind.
He is. He's a much nicer person than I am. He thought this was kind of had the melodrama of A Star Is Born, but brought an art house sensibility to it, sort of like an indie spirit to it. And that was very much his jam, not so much mine. So he gave this 4 stars. I would have given it 3 at most. But, you know, I have the black heart of Thanos, so
that is true. We can confirm that.
Yes, very much so, in fact.
So that is Brady Corbet's Vox Lux, which we gave 4 very generous stars to.
Oh, okay, then. 4 stars for Vox Lux. James didn't like it. He really didn't give a fox, but maybe you will. So maybe check it out this week. And that leaves us in Tolkien.
Yeah.
We're talking Tolkien.
Look who's Tolkien.
Indeed. Look who's Tolkien.
Well, it's
Nicholas Holt. Yeah. Mm. So it's a biopic of the early life of J.R.R. Tolkien.
Yes.
Going from his school days, where he's not always played by Nicholas Holt, it sort of starts off a little bit earlier than that, right up through his war experience and sort of, you know, just there's not very much of the film after the war, but there's a little bit of kind of dealing with that. But it's a matter of public record, so I'm sorry, I don't consider any of this a spoiler, but it's basically him meeting the woman who would become his wife, which he did very early on in his life, and he was in love with her forever, and they were actually crazy about each other. Mm-hmm. And also losing several of his closest friends in World War One, and being quite traumatized by that experience, and the ways that experience then fed into his later work in fantasy novels. So there's kind of some interesting stuff here. I think the problem is, you know, you were saying that it feels like there's more interesting stuff happening off screen in Vox Lux. There's a little bit of that going on here as well.
There's Lord of the Rings, which is clearly better.
Well, yes, and also, but you know, he, by the standards of World War One, I mean, he survived with all of his limbs intact. You know, he was certainly shaken up by it, as anyone would be, but he wasn't the primary victim here of the war.
Mm. This is perfectly decent stab, I would say, at a biopic. But you're right, there's not a lot of real drama in his life, other than he's not that privileged. He's not privileged as
his fellow
friends. And so he struggles a little bit to get along at university. It's weird. Structurally, the film's very weird. So it will flit around from World War One, where he's suffering trench fever, to him, you know, coming up, living life in Birmingham, and then moving on to university, and then falling in love with Lily Collins, Edith. But the World War One stuff, you know, he's in the trenches of World War One, so he sees people with flamethrowers, but then we see it as dragons, and at one point you see something that looks like Sauron. So the implication is that he was inspired by images that he saw in World War One, which, as you heard in the interview with Nicole, that Tolkien apparently then said, no, that wasn't the case. But
But obviously it may be unconscious and, yeah. and so on.
And it's
so
a bit of yeah. artistic license yeah. here, and that's, yeah. that's all fine.
You can imagine the meeting here. Yeah, we can do a thing on Tolkien. Yeah. How do we get dragons and Sauron into the World War One sequence? They're like, what?
Yeah.
I mean, it's in the trailer as well, isn't it? Like the dragon mm. bit. So it really feels quite manipulative.
Good dragon. It's a good dragon.
It gives good dragon.
Yeah, it really does give good dragon. Good performances throughout.
Yeah, good performances.
You know, Nicholas Holt is fine as
Tolkien.
That's him. That's a fellow. J.R.
Tolkien. He is
Tolkien.
A fellow as well.
Yes, indeed he did. Lily Collins as well is fine. Colin Meaney.
That's Gimli.
Derek Jacobi. Well, no, Gimli. Let's not talk about Gimli, shall we?
he doesn't let you get word in edgewise.
John Rhys appearance in Question Time, which caused quite the kerfuffle over here when he started yelling at people. Bad dates. But, you know, it's perfectly fine, perfectly decent stuff. And we gave this 3 stars. Mm. 3 stars for Tolkien.
Which is a recommendation.
Which is indeed a recommendation.
That you go and watch Lord of the Rings instead.
And I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, but Chris, who shot JRR? And the answer is Lasse Frank Johannesson, who is the cinematographer on this movie. So there we go.
I thought it was Maggie Simpson, so good to know.
The casting was made by Kate Ringsell. Coincidence or conspiracy? Find out in next week's episode of the Empire Podcast, because there will be an episode of the podcast next week, because that is it for this week's Empire Podcast.
Hurrah!
Hurrah! We made it! Join us next week for more film-related fun, where we'll be joined by... Get your art house hats on, everybody. Producer Jane's going to love this. Claire Denis. The legendary French director.
Claire Denis Villeneuve, the director of Dune.
Oh, my God.
The exciting upcoming movie.
Oh, no.
What a way to just erase a woman's achievements, James.
I know. I mean, idiot child.
Fair.
So she's her new film, High Life, is in cinemas next week, and we'll be chatting to her. Very,
hooray.
Very exciting. Very exciting indeed. Until then, until that auspicious occasion, until we meet again, it is goodbye from James Dyer.
Hey, kids, ask your parents where babies come from.
You see, he professes like not to like Teen Titans.
Do you see me laughing?
And then he quotes it.
The greatest closing line of last year. And it's goodbye from Helen O'Hara.
Toodaloo.
Toodaloo. And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to get poked in the back and have liquid sprayed in my face. Am I going to see Avengers Endgame in 4DX? Or am I going to DildoCon 19? Find out next week. Thanks for listening.
Oh,
see
God.
You next time. Bye.